Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with David Cutler, the Otto Eckstein Professor of Economics at Harvard, one of the key architects of major health reform efforts from the Clinton administration to the Massachusetts health law to the Affordable Care Act. He recently completed an analysis for the Journal of the American Medical Association and calculated the expected cost to the American economy from the pandemic will be $16 trillion. Lori Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with renowned health economist Harvard's David Cutler here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with David Cutler, renowned health economist and Otto Eckstein Professor of Economics at Harvard, also served at the Kennedy School of Government and the T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's instrumental in crafting the health reform effort under President Clinton, the Massachusetts health law, and the Affordable Care Act.
Dr. Cutler has served on the Council of Economic Advisors, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Academy of Sciences. He is the author of numerous books and articles, including Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for America's Healthcare System. And he was named by Modern Healthcare as one of the 30 people to have a powerful impact on healthcare. Professor Cutler, we welcome you back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you know, we enjoyed your piece in the Journal of American Medical Association, co-written with your Harvard colleague, Larry Summers, really trying to calculate the projected impact on the U.S. economy of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I guess it's fair to say the findings were pretty grim. You warned that based on the U.S. response to the pandemic or the lack thereof, the pandemic could end up costing the U.S. economy $16 trillion. I think the GDP for 2020 is around $21 trillion. So really a profound impact. I wonder if you could tell our listeners what metrics you looked at and how you arrived at your conclusion.
Yes, happy to. So you noted it's about 90% of 1 year's GDP, so it's a huge number. There are two primary inputs to the calculation that we made. The first one is what will be the lost output from the economy. So there are various macroeconomic models that have been developed over time that show what the economic output forecast is likely to be. Mm-hmm. So we used models that were out there, in this case, from the Congressional Budget Office, which tends to be pretty middle of the road on this. Yeah. And they estimate that it will be at least a decade before the economy recovers, and that'll be roughly $8 trillion of lost output over that decade. So that's about half of the economic loss. The second part of the economic loss is the loss from worsened health. And that is an economic loss just as lost output is. That is, lost output means you don't have money to consume things. Lost health means you don't enjoy life. So we use a very common technique of valuing statistical lives to measure the value of health impairment in three dimensions. One is for people who die. So we made a forecast of how many deaths there would be by a year from now, assuming that death rates remained at the relatively low rate of a few weeks ago rather than the new higher rate. Second is we added in costs associated with suffering among those who will survive COVID but have long-term, particularly respiratory and cardiac impairment. Mm-hmm. We've observed that with SARS, people who survive SARS, people who survive acute respiratory distress syndrome, and a variety of other conditions. And then third is we took account of the population's mental health impairment. That is, roughly 40% of people in the country now are reporting symptoms of anxiety or depression. And that had been about 10%. Mm. And so we said, look, that's 30% of adults who are now reporting symptoms of anxiety or depression. We need to take account of that. So we build in those three pieces, and that works out to about $8 trillion in total as well. So the total gets to be about $16 trillion.
Well, Professor Cutler, I really appreciate your focusing on the very real human cost of this pandemic. And I wonder if we could maybe look at just one slice of it around the impact also on the institutions that support people and the healthcare system. Many considered our healthcare expenditures already unsustainable, right? Before this, now we have 250,000 deaths, people who were cared for mostly in hospitals, millions of infections, the testing, the treating, the vaccine production, all of this adds up to another enormous load on our healthcare system and its expenditures that will likely far out surpass anything we've done to date. How do you see the healthcare system being able to respond to these enormous increased demands for expenditures? And at the same time, we also know they've had losses of revenue that they used to be able to count on. So kind of a double sword.
Yeah, it's very interesting because if you look at the healthcare industry, on net, spending on medical care is actually lower this year than it was last year and lower than it was in previous years. So for the first time ever, we're likely to finish 2020 having spent less on healthcare than the year before. And that's because the losses in terms of people not showing up for medical care in March, particularly April, May, June, right, were so large that they're greater than the medical care costs that we've now spent in terms of treating COVID and preparing for this winter and so forth. So the healthcare industry is really being hit very hard, on the one hand by lower revenues, mm-hmm, on the other hand by increasing spending on necessary PPE and so on. One of the ways that healthcare responded, which was unprecedented for healthcare, was that in the spring and summer, healthcare businesses laid off or furloughed a number of employees. And this almost never happens. Healthcare is virtually immune to recessions. And yet this particular time, they really had no choice but to let people go. So it was one of the leading causes of unemployment insurance in the spring and summer was the healthcare industry. Some of that employment has recovered, but not all of it. And so there's employment in healthcare is still below where it was.
You know, I want to pull the thread a little on sort of your modeling. I think we can stipulate, and you have been very articulate on this, that a nationally coordinated initiative of testing and contact tracing would have saved 30 times the expenditure because it would have been a better contained. I'm wondering about the vaccine, because it's in the news now. We've got two prominent candidates, others in the pipeline as well. Both have announced 95% efficacy rate. We've had Dr. Fauci on the show and a couple of times during the pandemic. And I know the last time he was on, he was hoping for maybe 60 or 70%. He would have been happy with 70% effectiveness. How does the vaccine roll into your model as well? And then certainly, I think the blocking and tackling of testing and contact tracing also, I'd love to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah, so the vaccine is a super welcome development. The 90-95% effectiveness is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. So that is just terrific news for people. One of the key questions is going to be, how quickly can we get the vaccine to people and enough people so that people feel comfortable going back out and doing the things that they were doing and so on. Almost certainly that's not going to be until spring, summer of next year. So the forecast that we had done that said, you know, what if the economy remains depressed and people remain fearful of the virus through a year, that's probably about accurate. Hopefully we will have overestimated a little. Hopefully it'll be sooner than that. In the interim, the question is, what do you do? And in some ways, what this does is it puts a lot more pressure to say, let's not hurry people back to work now, because everyone who becomes ill and either dies or has something bad happen to them just months before a vaccine is available, it's just terrible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it really puts a lot of pressure on saying, let's figure out ways to keep people going, but not expose them to situations where they're at a lot of risk. Whereas if you thought you were going to have to live with it for a while, you know, for a long, some number of years, you might say, okay, I'm going to ultimately have to get, you know, address it. So how do I think about it then? So I think this raises the value of things like testing so that people can know whether they are positive or not, whether it's, whether they're at risk of passing the disease on to others or not, contact tracing, and especially isolation and quarantining, so that we can really keep the virus as low as possible until we can get people vaccinated.
Well, Professor Cutler, I think you know from all your years of studying research, you know the flaws and you know the strengths of the U.S. healthcare system. And one of the weak points that we have been focused on for so long is the issue of health disparities and inequity, both in health and in healthcare. And certainly, it probably shouldn't have come as a surprise to us during this pandemic that people of color, people who are marginalized economically, have suffered probably the hardest consequences in terms of illness and death, and also the least likely to be insured and protected by leave from their jobs and the like. Tell us a little bit about your analysis of the impact of the pandemic on vulnerable populations in particular, and how you see where the health system has sort of risen to the occasion, where we fall short, what do we need to do better going forward?
Yes. So unfortunately, the pandemic, like everything, has exposed the rifts in society between the haves and the have-nots on the basis partly of race, partly of socioeconomic circumstance, partly of ethnicity, partly of living arrangements, and so on. And so in some ways, the pandemic is kind of awakening people to something that was always there. I think that the pandemic, though, has also brought a couple of other things of interest. One is, I think that probably the care for when people become very ill with COVID is relatively more similar by, for example, race than is the care for say, chronic disease. And so that's a hopeful sign that suggests that the medical system may be moving in a direction which says, we are going to work together to not tolerate a situation where care for some diseases is much better on the basis of socioeconomic status or race than it is for other diseases. And hopefully COVID will invigorate our efforts to do that. I also think that COVID is sort of showing us many of the social structures that we're going to have to address if we're going to have to address the broader issue of race and health. So for example, people say, well, you know, if you just equalized access to medical care. Well, for COVID, people have sort of equal access, but that doesn't solve everything. And so on. So we're going to have to address issues of housing and employment and living arrangements and medical care access and a whole bunch of things, rather than just thinking about kind of one-off kinds of policies that might, that where I think some of the debate had been beforehand. I also think that COVID will do one other thing, which is, you know, that with infectious disease, of course, what your neighbor does matters to you a lot more than with chronic disease. So if your neighbor is obese, you can say, well, you know, look, that's my neighbor and I'm not responsible for my neighbor. Therefore, I don't really need to worry about his or her obesity related issues and so on. On the other hand, their obesity now puts you at risk for them getting COVID and then an infectious disease and then passing it on to you. And so every city, every country, every state is going to have to think about the fact that they're only as strong as their weakest link. You know, so if I've got a group of people who are more likely to become ill from something that others can then catch, that's a problem right there in and of itself. I may not have wanted to deal with it, but I have to deal with it. So the idea that infectious diseases are still with us makes us care a lot more about the health of others than if it's all just chronic disease.
We're speaking today with David Cutler, renowned health economist, and the Otto Eckstein Professor of Economics at Harvard, whose recent report in the publication of JAMA predicts the pandemic could cost America economy some $16 trillion. You know, Professor, I wonder if you could help us understand how untreated mental illness exacts such a huge toll on the economy and how you projected that into your pandemic cost analysis. And I asked this because we recently had Pulitzer Prize winners Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wudan, who joined us to talk about a book they had written, Tightrope, really pointing out the economic factors driving the rise in suicide and overdoses of death. And you were talking about issues that we're going to have to deal with, and housing is one, but certainly the mental health disparity that we have in this country and how much the COVID-19 pandemic has raised the profile of our need to really start thinking more holistically about how we provide mental health services in this country.
Yes, so mental health, mental health impairment has gone up enormously since COVID. As best we can tell, it's increased from about 10% of the adult population to about 40% of the adult population. And if you look, you know, many hospitals are still low on the number of patients coming in through emergency departments and so on, with the exception of mental illness, which is increasing in prevalence. And there's no sign that mental health has gotten any less bad during COVID and the COVID recession than otherwise. It's really, we're very poorly equipped as a country to deal with mental health issues, and COVID is really exposing that. We have a very individualistic style, a sort of belief of kind of your own actions matter more than social actions. And then when things don't go well, that then tends to get blamed on individuals rather than on social factors. So that contributes to the problem, combined with the fact that historically we've so under-resourced the mental health sector. We've underpaid, we've underdone the number of mental health professionals and so on, that we don't have the capacity to treat people. Mm-hmm. That's making it very difficult. The good news, such as there is that the mental health provision has become enormously online, has gone enormously online. Mm-hmm. So telemedicine has come into mental health more than any other area of medicine. Mm-hmm. And that is great news, because getting to the mental health professional was always a big deal, and you know, the difficulties doing that and all of that. So anything that can be done to reduce the burden on people who need mental health care is great. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that we still don't have enough capacity to treat everyone who needs it. And so that remains a big problem.
Well, we would certainly agree with you that a silver lining, and it's hard to talk about silver linings in a pandemic, but making behavioral health services much more accessible through your phone or your computer has been a great step forward. But, you know, we see the impact on all the health disciplines. Your colleague, Dr. Koh, was with us recently, and he said, okay, another silver lining is nobody knew what a public health worker was before. Now everybody knows what public health is, from the epidemiology to the data scientists. People know where their local health department is, and that those people actually go out and do things like contact tracing. But we've seen the same with the public's recognition of who are our frontline healthcare workers and what do they do? You know, not the television series stuff, but really, what does that emergency room physician, that ICU nurse do, is now much better known, we think, to the American public. And I'm curious what you think the impact of the pandemic, among its many impacts, might be on the healthcare workforce as we go into the future. Is it likely to inspire more people to come into healthcare? Is it likely to change some of our education and training models, maybe more of a public health focus? What's your kind of future gaze on those issues?
Yeah, you know, like everything else, I think it has a mixed impact. So on the one hand, people are truly impressed, as they should be, with the treatment sector. That is, you know, in the middle of a pandemic where their own lives are in danger, people are going in to provide treatment. And that's just amazing. And they're doing it under incredibly difficult circumstances and without adequate reimbursement, without many times without appropriate, adequate protection and so on. On the other hand, if you talk to clinicians or if you listen to clinicians, there are quite a number who are saying, you know, I'm feeling burned out. I may need to retire. I'm not sure I can keep my practice open because of the reduction in revenues mm-hmm. and the increase in expenses. The telemedicine thing isn't going so well because it's so difficult to do. I'm not sure I have the infrastructure to make all this happen. I'm not sure I can manage having children and practicing medical care at the same time, and schools are not open and so on and so forth. So I think there is likely to be a wave of, even as we're celebrating medical professionals, we may very well also have a wave of healthcare professionals retiring and healthcare organizations merging with other organizations to get out of the practice of medicine by themselves, and all sorts of things like that mm-hmm. that are likely to put a lot of strain on the healthcare system, strain on patients. Not the of course, people are doing it not to create strain, but just because that's what has to happen. So I think that it's cutting both ways.
You know, I want to play with that thought for a moment, and I do want to acknowledge that you did a great piece on Freakonomics documentary, The Doctor Will Zoom You In Now. So there's sort of a crisis, and maybe there's an opportunity here. I think you're concerned that the medical health industrial complex or whatever is just very hard to move, and whether or not telehealth can really be brought in and bring about economies. But in that change, is there an opportunity for some transformation to occur? Because there are a lot of things in flux, and we simply are going to have to do things in a different way. Telehealth may be a force multiplier, it may not be. But how do you think sort of broadly about the opportunities and the concerns as you think about, is this an inflection point for the health industry that might bring about some positive changes?
Yeah, of course, all crises create changes, so some good, some bad. So we shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, before COVID, we worried that the medical sector was too big, that it was too institutionalized, that it was, you know, not effective at dealing with people where they are and so on. And so hopefully this can cause a reset in some of that. That is, if we said, you know, why is our goal when someone is sick to bring them to the doctor where by the way, they can make other people be sick? Like, shouldn't our first thought be, let's treat them at home unless we absolutely cannot treat them at home, and then we need to see them? You know, so sort of things like that. Or, you know, why are we sending this person to post-acute care, to a skilled nursing facility if they don't need it, if they can be home? So those kinds of changes would be very, very good if they lasted. I think some of it will depend on, you know, what happens with the reimbursement environment. And some of it will depend on whether the providers can make the IT infrastructure work. But I could well imagine a situation where a few years from now, we say, you know, a lot of that care never came back in person. And actually, that's really good. Mm-hmm. And we're saving our most intensive care for those patients who really need the most intensive settings. And that's great. That's likely to involve less employment in healthcare, but those people are very skilled and they can work in many other industries and occupations as well. And we shouldn't spend any more on healthcare than we need to. So that's my hope, is that some of this will teach us how to survive in a smaller, more efficient healthcare system.
We've been speaking today with David Cutler, renowned health economist and the Otto Eckstein Professor of Economics at Harvard. You can follow his vitally important work by going to scholar.harvard.edu/Cutler or follow him on Twitter @Cutler_econ. David, we want to thank you for applying your keen intellect and scholarly efforts towards the complex conundrum of the economics of the American healthcare system, and for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
My pleasure. Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Late in the presidential campaign, President Donald Trump claimed that state COVID-19 restrictions are a partisan ploy, with Democratic governors purposely keeping their states closed while Republican governors are opening them. But that doesn't square with the facts. For instance, in Bullhead City, Arizona, just across the border from Nevada, Trump wrongly contrasted the reopening actions of both states. In that speech on October 28th, the president said, quote, "In Arizona, you've opened up, but Nevada, get your governor to open up your state, please." So by Trump's telling, Arizona, which is run by Republican Governor Doug Ducey, is opened up, but Nevada, run by Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak, is not. But the reality is, both states have very similar restrictions. In late October, in both Arizona and Nevada, bars, restaurants, movie theaters, and gyms were all open, but use was capped at 50% of capacity. Jennifer Tolbert, Director of State Health Reform at the Kaiser Family Foundation, confirmed to us that the two states were in similar phases of reopening. In fact, Arizona has slightly tighter restrictions in some areas. For example, large gatherings are limited to 50 people in Arizona, but it is 250 in Nevada. Nevada is stricter than Arizona in one respect. Nevada has a statewide face mask mandate requiring people to wear them in public spaces when they come into close contact with others, such as on public transportation or in a business. Arizona does not have such a mandate and leaves it up to local governments to impose them if they want. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have Factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Danielle the Tutor had a revelation a few years ago, waking up on the cold floor of a jail cell. She could ask for help for her drug and alcohol addiction, or she could die. She chose the former. Tutor then launched not only on her own recovery journey, but on a broader quest to develop tools that could help all people grappling with addiction recovery to avoid relapse, which is so common, especially in the early days of sobriety. She realized that there needed to be more readily accessible tools for those in recovery to stay connected to their treatment goals beyond the 12-step meetings and the talk therapy sessions.
I am in long-term recovery, and I went through a 4-week inpatient treatment program where at the end of that 4-week program, all I received was a piece of paper that listed an enormous amount of things I'm supposed to do on a daily and weekly basis for the rest of my life to stay in recovery. And I knew that building something on our cell phones that are with us 24/7 would be a way to bridge that gap and keep people accountable through an app to those activities.
So she founded We Connect, a relapse prevention on-the-go mobile application that can be downloaded on a smartphone. The platform is designed to keep people engaged in their recovery plan using daily reminders and a reward system for when you perform the tasks that are essential to recovery.
The individual, along with the support of our certified peer recovery support specialists, are able to input those activities into the app. And when it comes time for that activity to start, you simply check into it. You see at the top of the app how you're earning your incentives. And by the way, this incentive program is based on evidence-based research called contingency management. So it's actually proven to show that it keeps people accountable to their recovery plans or their care plans. The way that we've digitized it and the immediacy of that incentive keeps people accountable to checking into those activities on the go.
And the digital platform also allows everyone who's connected to the person's healthcare ecosystem to see in real time activities that are enhancing recovery and also when one might be at higher risk for relapse.
We have trained peer recovery support specialists all across the country, and they get to leverage a tool that we developed called a data dashboard, where they can see in an instance if someone needs additional support or outreach. And that is built through the app, keeping them accountable to those activities and the peer having insights on how they're staying accountable to those activities in real time. So it really allows for this connection of support 24/7 and visibility so that when someone needs that added support, you know, not days or weeks go by, which is without this program is what happens, but rather gives insight and gives the option for connection in real time.
Since the pandemic hit, Tutor says the We Connect platform has been a lifeline for those in recovery, those now often cut off during the shutdown.
Actually, when the pandemic hit, immediately my heart went out for, wow, none of us have support meetings to go to anymore in person. So we immediately stood up with a set of partners, these mutual aid meetings that are online, that are led by certified peers. And within just a couple months, over 200,000 people joined from all states and several countries.
We Connect, a downloadable app designed by people in recovery for people in recovery to help maintain sobriety with a support system in the palm of their hand, keeping them on track with health goals, staying connected to a care team, and avoiding relapse. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.